Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. We are hanging out over here on the Nerd Party Network. Over at thenerdparty.com, you can check out all the great podcasts we have over there, from Star Trek to Star Wars to film to television and everything in between. There's so much great stuff there. Check it out. Also follow the Nerd Party at Join Nerd Party on Twitter and like the Facebook page, The Nerd Party. It's just The Nerd Party. It's also at The Nerd Party on Instagram if you're into that whole Instagram thing. And you know what? It's been way too long since I actually had another member of The Nerd Party on the show, so I am very delighted to welcome back Mr. Darren Moser. It's been so long. So
I'm
Darren,
back.
Welcome
it
back.
It has been a little bit. Well, you've been busy seeing movies, which is always good.
Excuse me. You've been busy being awesome and going to movie premieres, although not lately.
That's true. That's true. Oh, gosh, when was... Yeah, well, last time we did was The Abyss, but I don't remember when that was. Probably last year sometime, maybe.
I think you're right. I honestly can't remember the exact date, but it's been, I would say, at least a year.
Yeah.
Which is a shame. It's tough, you know.
It's because we've both seen so many movies. That's what's so hard. It's literally the point of this podcast.
I'm glad we figured it out. And this is another one that you picked. This is a movie that I haven't seen that you have seen, and that is Forbidden Planet, the 1956 seminal science fiction film. I know next to nothing about it, but Darren, give me a little preview, a little heads up of, first of all, how did you discover Forbidden Planet, and what's your relationship
with the film? I can't even think of when I discovered it. It's, again, one of those films that's just, well, it's been around for over 50 years, but... yeah, it's just, like you said, seminal. It's one of those things that if you haven't seen it, you've seen maybe a shot of Robbie the Robot, that kind of classic dome, you know, baritone voice just barking out orders. And yeah, 1956. So this was, it's weird to picture it in this regard. So this was shot on the same stage as Wizard of Oz. But to think how long ago it was, this was 17 years after Wizard of Oz. That close. I mean, I know it feels like Wizard of Oz is like forever ago, but they're actually really close in that regard. But yes, huge sets, huge production value. This is MGM trying to jump on the train and just be like, oh yeah, we'll make a science fiction movie and just throw money at it.
So this isn't an example of, because a lot of what I know, you know, when it comes to pre-Star Wars, a lot of what I know about great science fiction, I mean, there's 2001 A Space Odyssey, there's The Day the Earth Stood Still, but a lot of what I think about when I think of black and white science fiction from this era is not like what you're saying, where it's like, oh yeah, let's throw a lot of money into it. To me, I'm trying to find the place where, I guess in the 50s and 60s, science fiction was still kind of a hip thing, but like...
It was. It was popular, like right around but this not time that too. Popular.
Yeah, it wasn't hugely popular, but it's interesting to hear. For some reason, I always... I'm probably getting it confused with Plan 9 from Outer Space, but for some reason, you always...
Which I have
about,
seen as well.
Yeah, I've seen that as well, sadly. For some reason, I think of it as like cheap or something that's more hokey. But this is a movie that was a legitimate production. They put a lot of effort and star power and quality into the work they were doing, from my understanding.
They did. They really, I mean, the budget kind of got away from them a little bit. For comparison, Robbie the Robot at the time was the most expensive prop ever built.
Wow.
He cost $125,000 in 1956, which is a little over $1 million today, just for the robot.
But it's worth it.
But it's worth it. And he's so recognizable. And he would go on to have a career, and you would see him in lots of different places. And, you know, he was designed by actually the same, the designer also did B9, the B9 robot from Lost in Space. So you'll see a lot of similarities, the spinny, you know, circles on his head, and yes, the glowing, you know, quote unquote mouth, you know, and you can see they're the kind of distant cousins, and they actually meet, I think, in a couple of Lost in Space episodes.
That might be my, because I, you know, I'm familiar with Robbie the Robot, because I, like you said, this movie is so iconic that you, at the very least, you know that. Lost in Space was a show I loved as a kid. I watched it a lot, but that was something I definitely noticed. Like when I first saw Robbie the Robot, I noticed the comparisons between him and the robot.
I mean, personally, I like Robbie a little better. I think he's got a cleaner design. He probably had a way bigger budget. I mean, that's probably a lot of it. But
that's cool. I didn't know it was the same designer, and it makes perfect sense. I mean, now that you point it out, it's very clear.
Yeah, you can tell that they came from the same factory, if not the same, you know, maybe different mothers, same father, something like that. Who knows?
Something like that, yeah. So where, as far as science fiction for you, where does Forbidden Planet rank? Like, I mean, you grew up with this, obviously. You can't remember the first time you saw it, but do you remember, like, is it something like Star Wars is for so many of us, where you just know it's always been a part of your life, or was there a distinctive moment where you remember being like,
I definitely,
you know, like,
remember revisiting it during college, being a film student, and you know, we all like to sit around and be like, oh, let's watch this, or oh, you know, I roomed with three other film majors, so our collective movie collection was quite extensive, and this is like Blockbuster days, so it, you know, the access to stream things wasn't really there. You either had it on DVD or you didn't, or maybe VHS. So yeah, I remember revisiting it around, you know, 2000 2010, right in that range. But yeah, it's, I mean, I wouldn't say it's like my favorite movie, but it's one of those things, like 2001, like you said, it's a great movie. It might not be your favorite movie, but you can't deny what it is and kind of what it did for the genre. It's kind of one of those touchstones. This also did a lot of inspiring for Gene Roddenberry, because again, this is pre-66, so pre-Star Trek. Mm. And he kind of didn't, you know, directly take things from it, but it has been noted, and he has spoken, that this did kind of give him a bit of the inspiration to create Star Trek, which would have been, sure, about 10 years later.
That makes sense. And I know this movie has, it's highly regarded. You know, I didn't, because I know next to nothing about the movie aside, I know that it's Robbie the Robot, and I know Leslie Nielsen is in it, which,
yes, it is Leslie Nielsen's premiere film, the first film he was
really
in.
Because I've only, of course, I'm so familiar with him from his comedy work and Airplane and the Naked.
He doesn't have white hair. It's, you know, it's a little different.
It's a dramatic role.
He is the lead. He is the commander of the starship.
That is going to, I'm very, very excited to see that. But I tried not to look too deeply into the production. Because like I said, I know almost nothing about the film, and I kind of want to go into this completely blind and see it with fresh eyes. But the little I did read about it, I didn't realize, again, like you said, it had such influence, and its influence can be seen from Star Trek to all kinds of sci-fi. I didn't realize that. For some reason, Forbidden Planet, I thought, was kind of a guilty pleasure. And maybe it is, but I didn't realize it was held in such high regard.
I mean, it didn't, like, break the box office. I mean, it made back its budget, but barely. So it wasn't a giant commercial success. But I think, again, you see the money on the screen. Mm. Again, this isn't plot related, but again, it's shot on the Wizard of Oz ginormous soundstage. So they built like a 3/4 view of the spaceship. It's huge, and it's actually there. Because remember, it's 1956, so you have some ability to do things. But imagine a giant spaceship with a circle rama matte painting that's just going on and on and on for visual, you know, distance, and you feel like you're there. And this is the first sci-fi film where it never touches Earth. It's always on an alien planet, which is something else that's a little different. But, and it's in color. I mean, I know you'll get to that, but it's actually in color, which is nice. It's got a lot of great colors in it. And yeah, just again, I wouldn't say it's my favorite of the sci-fi, but it definitely ranks in as one of those touchstones. Like, people who are like, oh, Alien inspired me, blah, 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 yeah. You know, from then on. Or, you know, this is like the Alien of the 50s as far as inspiring the next 2-3 decades, you know, before we got kind of that resurgence of late 70s, 80s sci-fi.
Right. Do you think, based on our track record with The Abyss and Willow, do you think I'll enjoy this movie?
Oh, I think you'll definitely enjoy it. I think it's short, too. It's 98 minutes long.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was trying to remember, and I was looking up. I'm like, wait, is this like 2:10? And I looked up, like, 98. It's like, oh, that's like a Disney movie. That's like, that's really short.
It's like but an old Disney movie, because now Disney movies are like 3 hours long.
A classic Disney movie where you could just, you know, look at it and be like, oh, it's going to be 92, 94, 98 right. minutes. No, but I will say, though, the plot is well done. Like, it doesn't feel like, oh, they rushed it. It's like, this is their story. They tell the story is done. You know, it's that, and that's some good storytelling right there.
I'm genuinely excited, and hearing you talk about it and your experiences with it has got me more excited. You were showing off your Robbie the Robot collector's item, which can walk and talk, and I'm afraid may have a mind of its own. I don't want to.
Well, he's only maybe a little over a foot tall, but yeah, that's again. I think we just had an anniversary, which is why this toy came out. No, because 56. That doesn't. It's an old film. It's been around a long time.
Well, I'm excited to watch it. I say let's get to it, and we will be back to discuss.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. Darren, I am delighted to tell you that I was genuinely impressed with Forbidden Planet.
I'm really glad you liked it.
It was, you know, we talked about it before, you prepared me for it, but I still had in the back of my mind this just perception of what I thought this movie was. Again, Plan 9 from Outer Space is the thing I think about. I guess when I think of like
it's
crappy,
much better than that. Yeah.
Right. When I think of like crappy science fiction movies that are pre Day the Earth Stood Still, pre Star Trek, pre 2001 Star Wars, all that stuff, I just think of like cardboard cutouts, goofy looking monsters, things like that. Forbidden Planet is a legitimate film. Like, yeah. I would legitimately call it cinema. It's like you said, not the greatest sci-fi movie.
The money's
movie
on the screen, for sure.
It is. The money is absolutely there. It's not the greatest science fiction film I've ever seen, but it's unquestionably like a landmark movie. And yeah. I was surprised by how much it managed to pull me in. And I think part of that is, you know, it's in color, but also I guess they filmed it in, I don't know if it's the format or what you call it, but it's CinemaScope.
Right.
I don't know if that's the way it's projected or whatever, but it has this, by shooting it in widescreen, it has this fittingly epic and cinematic
feel. And you're shooting on this Circle-Rama giant matte painting, you know, set that, because you have to still remind yourself, wait, that's not green screen. Like, that doesn't exist. Like,
yeah.
They literally, everything you see there is in camera. I mean, obviously, like, some animation was done, which is always interesting. Actually, that's an interesting part to start, is Walt Disney, Disney Company loaned one of their animators to MGM to do all of those animations. So when you
I saw
the laser
Disney
effects,
is credited in the opening credits, and I was like, well, I wonder what that's all about.
Right. And and it obviously does like the Krell creature and the laser fence and the laser pistols, and it works great. Like, you still get a little bit of like they're aiming a little high and they just have to kind of animate it to look like
it's
going in the
right direction.
What I
thought was really
direction.
Funny about the laser guns is, you know, like you said, it's still impressive regardless. There are there are hokey effects in this movie. You can't avoid it. It's
1956.
You know, it's an old movie, but it actually feels shockingly contemporary. You know, there was never a point where I wasn't thinking like, yes, this is an older film, but it felt very modern. Like, it didn't feel like I wasn't taken out of the movie because
it has
a like
timelessness to it that I think has helped it or endure, versus again like Plan 9 or something else where you're like, oh, that was great, but boy, the rough edges.
Yes, and there's something charming about the effects. Like, for instance, the thing that got me about the laser guns is that there's no sense of the people holding
recoil.
Them firing anything.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
just kind
they're
of
literally just standing there.
They're standing there pointing their guns and like little laser beams are coming out of it.
They're
but
probably
no
not
sense
even
of
squeezing
recoil.
A trigger. They're just pointing them.
Yes, exactly. So there's this things like that are more charming than anything else. But I think you're right. You bring up the in-camera stuff. I was time and time again really, really blown away by the work they pulled off here. I can't think of something to compare it to off the top of my head, but I feel like I've seen films from later decades that don't look as good as this movie. It actually, I was getting flashbacks to Metropolis.
Yes.
Fritz Lang's Metropolis, in terms of just like watching the movie and feeling like, how was this made in this time period?
Right.
This is,
it feels out of time. Like you think 56, like, no, not the 60s, not the early 70s. No, 50s. Like we had just ended, like we're just out of war two, World War
right.
II. Like it's, that's a long time ago.
It really is. And you get the, I mean, again, from just judging from other films that are out during that time and TV shows and things, that you kind of had this feeling like, oh, I know what science fiction is at this time and it's kind of hokey. But Forbidden Planet, for the most part, it's playing it pretty straight. And it has that kind of human streak that I was not anticipating. You know, it's not like, this movie is not particularly
it's
not complex.
It's
not like
complex.
This,
no, I think
it's not
loosely
this, like,
based on The Tempest. I think really
I heard
loosely.
That too.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about The Tempest. So
I think a little bit with the id and ego and stuff and like that. But like I told you before, if you take out the sci-fi part, it's basically a bunch of sailors on a ship that go rescue a stranded crew and crazy things happen. Like,
right.
You could take off, if you take off the sci-fi varnish, that's the basic story, and they play it straight like that, which I think helps.
And it definitely, the Star Trek influences are so clear because of the idea of like, oh, it's basically like the Navy in space.
Yes,
but the,
space
a lot
Navy.
Of the stuff, even from the get-go, the way they frame the ship itself, and they all, I don't know, I guess they were doing a test or something, or if it was lights, they were going into light speed. But they stand in these devices that look like transporters.
Right.
And I thought for a second, I was like, oh, are they transporting?
They were decelerating. So they
right.
were a deceleration field, basically, so they didn't get, like, atomized against the bulkhead. So
right.
they had to, which also is a pretty sound sci-fi concept. Like, that, I mean, like The Expanse, current modern sci-fi, they inject drugs into their bloodstream when they're accelerating to compensate for the G-forces. And that's basically what they do in this movie, just with a light show.
That's what I'm saying. It's a lot of stuff in this that I don't think I ever expected. I didn't expect the movie to be so smart. It's very smart, and it's grounded to the extent that it needs to be grounded. Like, everyone, there's nothing.
You got the comic relief cook. You got the, you know, it's a lot of, it's fun. It's a fun family movie. It really is.
And Robbie the robot is amazing.
Yeah. Robbie's so
amazing.
Good.
And, you know, something else, we talked about it a little bit, but first of all, like you said, the money is on the screen. Robbie looks like flipping fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible the amount
of
work they
put into
that.
You know, it's a guy in a suit, but you forget that very quickly.
Yes, yes. And it's just the little, like, the gizmos and the way the lights move on his face when he's talking. I loved that so much. And I love that. I didn't even think about the fact that this was one of the earliest examples of a robot kind of playing a character in a way, as opposed to just kind of being bland and not having an identity, not having really a distinctive personality. Robbie was really a landmark in cinema for that, which I didn't realize until I was reading about the film afterwards.
Well, and I love the just the fact that he is a part of that world through and through. I mean, the fact that the car, he literally just docks into the front and drives it, which makes way more sense than him, what, sitting in a chair?
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't make any sense. But if you just have a car that Robbie's going to drive, just plug him in the front, and there
exactly.
he goes.
Yeah, and I love, I mean, he has, like very these dry punchlines, like someone it's like he says something about oxygen, like I rarely use oxygen myself. It promotes rust. It's just very, very, very funny stuff. So the movie, it's like it's got this undercurrent of humor, but I think again I was most impressed by the fact that it's very it's all played straight. It's right. not hokey.
Everybody plays it straight.
Yeah, it's not. And speaking of, I mean, just talking about playing it straight, Leslie Nielsen,
yeah.
who, like I said, I've only seen in like the Zucker Brother comedies and
Airplane,
things like that.
Yeah.
First of all, he's fantastic in this film.
He's
I
really
wish
good.
I can't help wondering like what else he was in where he was playing a more dramatic role. I imagine there's more out there. I would love to see it because he's so good. The other thing I couldn't stop thinking was he looks like Daniel Craig. And maybe yeah. that's just me wanting No Time to Die to be out right now and wanting to watch it. But I'm not kidding. He looks like Daniel Craig. Like young Leslie Nielsen is essentially Daniel Craig.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure part of that's the haircut, you know, a little, you know, straight cut. And but yeah, you could, you know, if you were rebooting, why you ever would. But if you were rebooting Forbidden Planet now, I could see Daniel Craig as the Commander Adams.
He could pull it off.
And he's the full-on commander. I mean, he's given orders. Like that's what I think sells it. In the very beginning, when you're just coming in on the spaceship and he's just like, he grabs his, you know, little microphone off the bulkhead and just says, hey, let's do this. Like they do it in such a way where it's not overladen with techno speak. I mean, there is some, but they play it so simple where it's like, get ready to do X. Okay, crew, we're going to go to condition 2. And it's just, you feel like you're on a battleship. You don't feel like you're on a spaceship. And what a spaceship. I mean, that set is so amazing with the giant sphere in the middle with the model.
I loved that.
The
I
little thought, like run up and down hoists as they
the
get the
design
up to
the
upper
of
leg.
The spaceship itself, like the exterior is goofy. Like it looked, that was a little,
it's
like
a
that's
straight think, up flying saucer.
Yes.
I mean,
it's a straight up flying. That was, I think that's the first thing you see in the movie.
It is.
So
it's
I was kind of like,
thing.
Oh, okay, well this is kind of what I expected. And then the rest of the movie kind of threw me for a loop and surprised me. But I think that was the one design element that I was not completely into. I was like, this, like you said, it's a flying saucer.
Yeah.
It looks like a stereotypical, like I can just imagine somebody who's like, oh, Forbidden Planet. Okay. I'm going to turn it on. But if there's anything like goofy or dumb, it's like I could just, that little flying saucer flying into frame and just looking like that. I could
well,
just
I'm glad you watched past
like,
the flying saucer because it sure gets good after
it does
that.
It does get much better than that. I think if there's anything that didn't necessarily work for me, and it's not really something that took away from the film, it's almost like the film is so captivating in terms of what it's showing you. Like it's just basically, it's essentially an effects film, but it's not like cold like a standard effects film, I guess. It's very like it has heart, it has humor, and it has, like you
They're
said, this kind of confidence
effects.
And groundedness in the way everyone talks to each other. It's recognizably human, even though it's taking place in this other world with these kind of weird things happening. You can recognize the human qualities. I think I was trying to kind of gel with the plot and figuring out where it was going. And the movie never really, it has a couple things going on. And it's like, first, it's kind of like, okay, we're going to, it's kind of a rescue mission sort of, where we're going to find this team to see what's happened to them. Then they get there and they find this guy, Dr. Morbius.
Morbius, yeah.
And his daughter, and everyone Altera. Is in love with the daughter.
Yes.
Is it Altera?
Yeah, Altera.
Altera. So, I mean, and she's gorgeous. And the guys are immediately like, hey, what's up? And the dad is basically like the guy, there's... Yeah.
And all make, three of them. All three all of the men are just like, them. Well, I mean, they even have the wolf whistle from the camera.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
so
they're not hiding that at all. Yeah.
At the very least, Commander Adams is like, he's like, hey, cut it out.
He's a little restrained, but I mean, he ends up with her at the end.
He does. So it just, you know, if you play hard to get it, that's how it always works. But like, I just thought that was so funny that, there's no shame, there's no hiding it. I think one of them like is talking, like she goes off with one of the other guys and the dad comes over and it's like, oh, it's good that she gets to interact with males and she's never seen it. And the other guy responds is like, well, I'm enjoying the view from over here. And I was like, this is her dad. And even crazier, the dad is like, yeah, that sounds about right.
I mean, there's a line where the dad or Dr. Morbius says, well, I feel I might eventually need to make the trip to Earth for her natural development. And then they're all like, yeah, pretty soon, I'd say,
too. And it's like, what? Yeah.
I think it was even funnier that the dad was kind of just like taking it all in stride, like not reacting as if like, hey, come on now. Come on, guys. It's just like, yeah, this is normal. I thought that was funny. So the movie, I was kind of like, okay, I guess it's sort of like weird romance maybe. And then it kind of shifts into like, there's this weird creature kind of stalking, this invisible creature is killing people. And it kind of goes in like a bunch of different directions. And it was hard to, not difficult to follow, but it was hard to kind of figure out like, all right, where are we going with this? What are we trying to do?
And I get that also where, I mean, I've seen it so many times that I just kind of, maybe it's one of those movies where on the second viewing where you're not trying to figure out where the plot's going and you just kind of let it wash over you.
Yeah.
It might click a little more, but that's a good point. Cause it does, you know, I've never really thought of watching this for the first time. What did I think the plot or the, you know, tone was going to be? I just kind of watched it and I could be like, oh, is it romance? Is it horror? Is it, you know, crazy stuff inside the mind? And it's kind of all those things.
It's a bunch of different things. Yeah. And that's the other thing is the reason it didn't really bother me. It was more as I was watching it, just trying to figure out like, okay, what am I supposed to be following? Like, how am I supposed to be?
What is
going to carry me through this movie? It didn't really like, it didn't bother me enough to make me be like, oh, this is so stupid. What is this about? This has no plot. It was more just trying to like, I'm like, where are you going with this? Am I like, what kind of movie?
And then all of a sudden it throws like the krill out and you're like, whoa, okay. Yes. It's like you get this huge exposition dump from the doctor where he's like, millions of years ago.
End.
You're like,
I mean,
oh, okay. I guess this is what the movie's about now.
We're talking about the last 30 minutes of the movie. Yeah. All of a sudden it's like, and by the way, the krill. And I was like, the krill?
Yeah.
What is going on?
Let's introduce them 2/3 of the way through this movie.
But you know was so funny about that. I think maybe if it had just been them talking and like, and it had just been, you know, simple shots of them just standing and talking heads and things like that, it would have been one thing. But again, the movie, the charm of the movie is the fact that it's like, and now it's going to be this and then it's going to be that. And part of what's so great about that whole sequence is I'm kind of like, what's going on? And then they're like, hold on, we'll show you. And then this incredible effect sequence where they're walking through these vast rooms. I was so blown away by what they were able to pull off with just like in camera effects and optics, and just trying to like wrap my head around like, okay, so this is probably a matte painting, this is probably a model, but it looks so good. That's where I think I got the strong Metropolis vibes from.
When they go down and he's like 20 miles, you know, this direction, you have a lot of the traveling mats. And it something about the fact of the film and the grain and the matte, and it just all blended. Like, you really got to look for the seams. It's really, really well done. And they keep it really simple. I mean, there's textures and stuff, but it's not like they're jamming a ton of stuff in the frame. When they look down into the, you know, 50-mile deep chasm, and you have these giant, you know, pieces of the machinery moving up and down and arcing electricity and the generators, it's a beautiful spectacle. I mean, it's just pure spectacle.
And like you said, the seams aren't necessarily pronounced like they have been in other effects heavy movies from later periods that somehow don't work as well. And I think it's like you said, it's because they don't call attention to it. It's not flashy. It's not like, all right, and here we go into the crazy.
Well,
it's
all like the camera's not flying around. It's they're wide. They're not locked off shots. They are traveling mats, but the people are like, maybe, you know, they're tiny in the shot, but they move enough that you can tell, that's the scale of a person compared to this giant machine they're standing next to.
Yes. And there's also, I mean, it's like, you can see sometimes if you like are looking with a really, really critical eye, it's like, okay, that's rear projection, that's this and that. But for the most part, I was so impressed with how they managed to get all these elements so seamlessly together. It feels like sometimes you have to kind of, with an old special effects movie, you really, really have to suspend your disbelief and kind of just be like, all right, this was the time. I didn't really have to do that much with this film, which makes it more impressive. The budget was huge, but it's still, for 1956, for them to pull that off and to have a very seamless, effective effects sequence, like in the midst of all these things where people are walking and talking and these fantastical things are happening around them, that was really, really cool. And I really, really, I was very impressed by that.
But
I like how they explain. They explain. It's a lot of exposition, but they're showing while they explain, which I think is helpful. Like they say, well, what do they look like? Well, we don't know, but this is what their doors are shaped like. And you start to build a picture in your mind of this squat, pointy-headed, you know, monster. And again, watching it again, knowing what they think the Krell look like from the animation later on, you start to notice, like the chairs have like a space for a tail and, you know, things like that where you're like, oh my gosh, like it actually all kind of starts to, it's really well thought, thought out.
Well, the production design is incredible. I mean, it all feels like there's a world there and it feels like very, very good world building in general. They put a lot of thought into this, a lot more thought than I would have expected from a film made, a science fiction film in the 50s.
I mean, there's not really any plot holes if you think about it. I mean, I'm sure there's something that I'm not thinking
of. But, someone out there could point out something at some
point. But it's not like, well, then what about this? It's like, no, they pretty much cover their bases, and especially of selling a fantastical story of a race that's been dead for millennia, you know, you kind of have to cover your bases or it's going to kind of fall apart. But I think you said it best where you're like, they put a lot of thought into it. They kind of knew what they were doing.
Yeah. And that kind of influence in terms of building a world that exists, that's tangible. We see that so much. It's actually Forbidden Planet feels like, you know, it's recognized as seminal sci-fi. But it's also the fact that you can see so many influences, and Star Trek is the one that really leaps to mind.
Yeah.
But even Star Wars, even though Star Wars is not overtly futuristic and it's kind of taking on a more fantasy vibe, it's still the mindset of build a world that's believable so that your audience can just buy completely into it.
Interject robots into it seamlessly where they are just, it's a robot.
Exactly.
And they even explain, Robbie, like they even have the crew going, where'd this robot come from? This is beyond Earth science. And he's like, well, and then about a couple scenes later, you learn that he had expanded his intellect with the machines and he'd built Robbie. And you're like, oh, okay. There's a small plot hole that you just closed and you explained. And what did you think about the effects they did for the invisible Krell, like the footprints sinking into the ground and the stairs bending under the weight? It was, I love that part.
It's so cool to go back and watch, because a lot of times we talk so much about what's, you know, CG versus practical, and I firmly believe there's a healthy balance between both, where it's if you're going to use them, try to find the balance where you mix it. You don't just focus and lean too much into one particular direction. You try to meld them and make it invisible. But what's so much fun is going back to old movies like this where they rely a lot on effects that you, even now, it's like, okay, how are we going to make this possible? And to think, like, there is a crew that
I'm trying
is
to think
using...
how did they do that? That's actually harder to figure out.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking. It's like, this is a crew that's like, they don't have the technology available today to pull off these things even practically. There's a lot of problem solving happening in that these little moments. And the footprints in particular, I was so, again, just, I was also thinking of like Jurassic Park and things like that. And just like, where do these motifs kind of come back into play? But I was just trying to think, how do you, what did they do? And
I mean,
how clever.
I was trying to think about it. And my thought is, well, obviously they built up a section of the set. Like, it's not the floor. It's like up like maybe 2 or 3 feet. And then they must have something that's perfectly flat. But then when they pull down.
Yeah.
Lets the sand kind of like sink.
They could have maybe like shaped, they filled in the sand, they kind of brushed it off on top to kind of blend it in with the rest of the ground. But maybe what they did is they took the shapes and then someone, like you said, they built up a set, and then underground maybe somebody's pulling out.
Yeah, but you'd have to pull it out at the same time. Like, it's not like they pulled a board across, because it didn't fall from left to right. It just sunk.
Exactly. And so you would have to time it perfectly.
Well, yeah. And it also made me think, like, I hope they didn't have to do multiple takes, because resetting that would be, because you have the camera tracking it too. It's not just a wide shot. So if the camera is too slow or too fast and you miss the, because he's got to know, okay, I'm right here, and then it's because there's no real visual reference. I mean, I'm sure they knew where it was, but they have to know, okay, move the camera to here. There's going to be a footprint in half a second right there.
Right. That was, yeah. I mean, that was the other thing. Like you said, the camera moves a lot. Like it feels very cinematic. It doesn't feel like there are locked off shots. Like like the optical effect with the tiger was one of the only, like there's a point where you can see through the tiger and it's very clearly not with her.
When it's closest to Altera, she does have a little bit of a fade.
Yeah.
But again, you know, for people not looking that closely, people were like, oh, she wasn't right next to the tiger? Like, no, she was never in the same shot as the tiger. It's a bunch of traveling mats and lenses and things like that. But it sells it pretty well.
There are things like that where you could, you know, they had to lock down the camera because they didn't know what else to do. But there's a surprising amount of movement. Like, it doesn't, the effects are typically locked down, but you mentioned there's a lot, there are moving shots, there are moving mats. They really focus on the filmmaking first and telling the story visually, which also really impressed me. The fact that it doesn't seem like it's a movie that was made, even though the effects, I think, are one of the key points of this movie that makes it such a success, it doesn't feel like it was driven exclusively by that. Like, they were like, okay, we have to do this because it'll look really cool. It's all driven by story and what's happening.
Which is funny because you think, you know, nowadays we have to make that distinction where it's like, no, give me a good story first or we're not going to make your movie. Then you figure out how to make it and what effects to use.
Yeah.
I mean, we all can tell how they did it. The simple shutters on the house where he waves over a control and it's like, ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk.
Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously they like, okay, shoot half a frame, then stop the camera, then put the thing in and then shoot another half a frame. But it works.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't need to be any, we don't need to see them popping up from the ground. Like the fact that they're instantaneously there works really well. And it gives a sense of strength, which is paid off later when the Krell creature is burning through it and smashing it. And they're like, oh my gosh, like, there is some good setup and payoff as this goes. Like it's not, not everything is set up and payoff, but the moments that are like the thickness of the metal or nothing could survive that much electricity or something like that. And it makes you, I haven't ever heard anyone who watched Forbidden Planet who was like, I didn't get the story. Like, there's some parts where you got to kind of, it is kind of going a little deep with like,
I think near the end, when they start to talk about like, oh, I expanded my mind.
Yeah.
And then it starts to turn into like my consciousness has taken a form, then it starts to get a little weird, which is stuff. I love that kind of stuff. But also, I think that's the only time it starts to kind of, it's like, all right, come on, audience. We're going to pull you along with us. You got to work with it.
But they back that up with, you see Morbius collapsed on the control and you see all the gauges at max. And that's enough where they've again prepped where it's like, look, I'm turning on this machine and it's barely registering. And now half the room is lit. You're like, oh, he's doing it. Like you start to almost realize it before the characters tell you.
Right. Well, I think that's
it's a bit of a stretch, but they do help you get there.
No, I think you're right. I think that's the brilliance of it's Fred Wilcox, his direction. And I'm sure it was, everything from the production design and getting those lights set up, but you're absolutely right. I think a lot of the confusion, you kind of stop it before it can start because, like you said, they have carefully explained and set up, like, here's this machine, here's what it means when these lights are all, like, there are only a couple lights right now, and here's what it means when there are more lights, and there are things like that. So they do a really good job of setting the audience up so you're not really ever lost. You always have a really, really good feel for where you are, what's going on, what's happening. So even when it goes like a little nuts near the end, you're still kind of like, you're using those visual cues to orient the audience and you're making sure that they, even as things get more outlandish and weird, they still have some sense of, okay, he said that machine, when all the lights are on, it means this, and this means that. And maybe
that's why it works that they really don't induce the Krill until that last third, because they've set so much groundwork in this world. I mean, I can't imagine them explaining it in the first third. I think it would be too much.
It's too much to try to set that whole thing up. They do a good job of teasing. I think any weaknesses with the plot are like trying to, like, it's like, is it a romance? And the threat of the Krell is so it's there, but you this guy's basically like, oh, this thing killed all my crew members, and then there's this invisible enemy kind of moving.
Right, you can see throughout. The foreshadowing of like, and I'm immune. It's like right. It's you, but I mean, you know, you can't make that distinction.
You get this
yet.
Feeling that something is not right. So they do a really good job of setting that up, and maybe like it could have just been like me just being like, well, we're tonally because it goes kind of romantic comedy for a little bit, and it's like, hey, now all these guys are trying to charm this pretty girl. Right. I think I was just sort of like, okay, so is it just going to be her learning about how, like, is it going to be kind of goofy
but
fish out of
really
water?
But she's really a tertiary character. It's really about Morbius and the captain, the Commander Adams. Like, they're running the show. Like, really, the whole plot is about them and their battle of wits, as it were. Yeah. And then, now, what did you think about the electronic tonalities?
I love that. And I wrote that. That was one of the first notes I wrote. I love that, first of all, this is, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is it the first electronic score, or the first score that includes a significant chunk of electronics?
And that's the main reason that they had to call it electronic tonalities, because the Musicians Union forced MGM to do it. They basically said you can't say music, and so it couldn't get an Oscar for music, because they're like, no, this isn't music, this is like, and I mean, we're still fighting that fight nowadays, it feels, but they didn't get anything for it.
That's
but,
so funny. Well, you know, it's, you know, later on when it comes to effects, Tron in 1982 didn't get nominated because they said they cheated by using computers.
Exactly, it's exact the same thing. Yeah.
So I
just ahead
but
of
I
his time
thought, man, again, talk about things that this movie is full of things that just impress me, and the score is one of them, because it feels very modern. It feels like a very modern, it feels like a score that you would find in a modern kind
but
of...
But it's not like 80s synth. It's
not like corny.
Not.
It feels like very... it's almost like you would find it in a creepy sci-fi horror movie. Like, it's something that would be right at home in a movie like Ex Machina, you know? It felt...
You feel the theremin. It's got a lot of theremin in it, you know, and just that kind of, like, wine-ish tone. But, yeah, they build tension with it. They use it to represent the monster. They use it to represent all sorts of things. So it's...
And I'm a big electronic music fan. I'm a big Kraftwerk fan. And I'm thinking about Kraftwerk, like... This was the 70s and 80s where they were kind of paving the way for electronic music. And I'm like, this is 20 years before Kraftwerk was even doing it. And they were actually creating music that's, like you said, it creates drama, it creates emotion, it gives you this sense of foreboding, but it is unmistakably a soundtrack to a movie.
I was
so amazed.
There's themes that for the Krill, there's themes for the underground structure, there's themes for peril. And it just, because it's a cinema score. It really is. No matter how it was made, it's a cinematic score.
Yes, exactly. So I was very impressed with that. And there is a lot of stuff technically, again, that just just blew my mind because I wasn't expecting it. You just, science fiction, even back then, it still wasn't respected to the point where this movie, I'm actually kind of amazed that it didn't end up blasting open the doors. I know it was still a modest success, but I am kind of shocked that it didn't reach more people. I'm curious as to why. I couldn't find any information as to why it didn't connect, but what do you think? Do you think it was just too ahead of its time? Because it's a very... It's not like 2001 A Space Odyssey, where that is a bizarre movie where I can understand like an audience member going into that and walking out and being like, I don't know what happened.
And
I
it's also
understand.
Really long. I mean, this is only 98 minutes. So it starts, it tells its story, and it's done. I mean, what do they say in writing? Like, you're from your climax to the end of the movie should be like that. Like, as soon as you've had your climax, just end.
You're done.
You're done. And that's pretty much it. Like, as soon as they defeat Morbius, they're like, okay, the planet's gonna blow up, get off the planet, and Let's go. 5 minutes the movie's over.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, okay.
And what's her name is on the she's on the ship with them, and she's like, all right, well, my dad's dead.
Yeah,
all right,
let's watch the planet blow up through the viewer, sweetie. Okay, it's gone now.
But it's very, it's not like
it invites the audience in a way that 2001, again, 2001, a brilliant movie that I love, it doesn't necessarily invite the audience in to be like, yes, we're going to take you along with this ride. It's a little bit more like, you're going to enjoy this or you're not. And if you don't, well, who cares? This movie, it's stunning to me that it didn't do better simply for the fact that it feels modern. It feels human and it feels generally entertaining. It doesn't feel like science fiction in the way that I think people think of it. Where it's like, oh, it's weird, it's nerdy, it doesn't make any sense, I don't understand, there are robots. This feels like it was designed to appeal to a mass audience and to pull in people who might not necessarily be into this kind of movie, which is why it's just a little shocking to me that it didn't do better than it did.
I think it's interesting how, if you think about it, the only thing that really survived Forbidden Planet was Robbie the Robot. Like, that's the thing that everybody remembers that went on to have, you know, be in specials and to tour around places and have sequels and things like that. But it wasn't the crew or the whatever or the plot or, you know. So it's like, I think part of it is a little bit ahead of its time. But, and then the only thing that everyone could really latch on to was Robbie. And that became, you know, the main part of the success. But again, you know, I mean, we live in a time where science fiction is thriving. Like, people love science fiction. But it was still, you know, it was still a rarity to have a science fiction. It was a extreme rarity to have science fiction that was that well funded, especially back then. So maybe even if it was still a success, they just didn't know what to do next. Like, what do you, like, we're not in the age of a million sequels and trilogies and stuff like that. So what do? You have the breakout robot that everybody loves and you put him in something else.
Yeah.
And he just becomes part of your, you know, library of stars. Cause this is back in the day when, you know, you would have to rent out and loan stars cause they were connected to the studios.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think you're right. I think a lot of it has to do with that, but it is amazing to think that, like, this movie kind of paved the way for everything else in terms of, if this is the first time a studio said, okay, let's put aside a significant chunk of money to a science fiction film, it's clearly not the last time that happened, but this is the first time it really happened on this scale. So at the very least, even though it's not a rousing success, it didn't make a ton of money, it still opened the doors for science fiction to be a respected film genre. And I think that might be just as important.
Well, it kind of reminds me about, you know, a decade ago, we started to get really hard science fiction, meaning like Gravity and things like that, where it wasn't, I mean, it was science fiction in the fact that it wasn't real, but it was using real principles and spaceships and things like that. And we've been getting a lot more of that now, which I think is great. And yeah, I mean, that's just pretty much the Hollywood formula. If it works, it will encourage and spawn more of the same like. And, you know, we did get some good, you know, science fiction later. I think it really had to just be MGM that took that bullet because they were so big and so capable to make that film. I mean, yeah, I honestly think a smaller studio might not have succeeded where they did.
Yeah. Yeah. So is there anything watching it? This is obviously it's been. You've seen it
innumerable times, yes.
Yeah. So is there anything you noticed on this latest viewing that maybe didn't strike you in earlier viewings?
It was interesting. I think just watching it again, just to kind of let it wash over me, I felt maybe just not as connected as I thought I would after watching it. Cause again, you think like, oh, Forbidden Planet, I love that one. But again, like I said, when we pre-talked, you know, it's not like my favorite science fiction movie. It's not one that I'm always going to pop in, but I'm definitely not going to say no if it's on, you know, television or something. So I guess that was kind of what struck me, is it kind of re-cemented itself as like a middle of the pack, really good film, but not like, you know, one I'm going to watch every year or something like that. But still it does stand up. And I think a good part of that is, you know, you have really good actors and they're playing it straight. I think if they had started to, you know, I don't know, spout technobabble and spout, you know, just craziness, and you get a little bit of the 50s stuff, especially with the, you know, the wolf whistles and stuff, but I really like the crew, and you start to learn their names, and you know that, you know, the from the cook to the, you know, to the chief to, you know, the commander, and all in between. Like, this felt like a crew of men that were off, yeah, you know, doing their jobs, and they got their space truck and their, you know, laser fence, and you know that part is fantastical, but the rest of it, like, you do connect with the characters, which I think is so important, because you want them to succeed, you want them to get away, you want them to uncover the mystery, and it's not easy for them. Like, they have to take apart half their ship to call home. It's not just like, oh, let me just push the button and we have our answer. It's like, no, we have to make a sacrifice, and now that's a problem if we have to get away soon.
Yeah, that's ultimately key to what makes the movie work so well, is that at its core, it has a really solid story. Because I'm with you. I think it's a seminal film for sure. I think film fans and science fiction fans in particular owe it to themselves to see this, to recognize definitely. It. It's not something where I would, like, I wouldn't put it on the same level as Metropolis, which I mentioned. Metropolis is just, like, mind-blowing in every sense. 2001, Star Wars.
And Metropolis, people have remade in different ways and genres. Yeah. Like, that's a core story archetype almost. Like, yeah. Seventh Samurai or something
like
that.
Yeah. Like, it's one of those. Forbidden Planet doesn't necessarily transcend to the level of, like, masterful cinema. But as a science fiction film, it definitely transcends what that genre was at the time. And it opens the doors for the possibilities of what it could be. Like, I'm 100% on the same page as you, where it's not necessarily a film I'm going to rush out and be like, everybody, you've got to go see it. I've got to show it to my wife. I've got to show it to my friends. But it is one where if it comes up in conversation, I'll be like, you know what? That's a movie I'm kind of shocked nobody talks about. It feels like maybe the reputation of kind of B movie, monster movie gets assigned to it, and it's not really merited. It's something that's better than that. It's not quite gonna blow you away completely, but I think it holds a lot more value than it maybe its reputation suggests.
Yeah, it's definitely worth talking about, and again it's short. It does what it needs to do, and then it's done. It doesn't, I mean, this could easily suffered from, like, oh, it was good, but boy, that third act just, like, died. Like, but it doesn't, because they didn't try to pad it out to be 120, 140 minute, you know, film, which there wasn't enough story to support that.
So what exactly, you said there are sequels?
Well, there's, I haven't looked a ton into it, but from what I've seen, the quote unquote sequel, it's more like the next film that Robbie was in. So I don't think it has anything to do with Forbidden Planet. It's called The Invisible Boy. And it's black and white. It's like on Earth. It's not, you know, it's the next, came out the next year. And I think it's just, yeah, it's a 10-year-old boy and Robbie team up to prevent a supercomputer from controlling Earth from a satellite. Like, it's very 50s science fiction.
Yes. That sounds more like what I would have expected this movie to be.
Well, even the name, and maybe the name, like, it's not a bad name, Forbidden Planet, but it sounds, I mean, it reeks of science fiction. I mean, it sounds like a B-movie title.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't, I mean, I don't really what else you could make it. I mean, it's good enough on its own. But, I mean, I think there's even comic shops called Forbidden Planet.
Is that the one, is that in New York?
I think that's the one in New York.
Oh, I love that shop. It's been a long time since I've been to New York, and it's probably going to be even longer until I go back. But that shop is super awesome. I also am just reading through, and apparently George R.R. Martin says this is his favorite science fiction film.
That's cool.
There you go.
Think of the suspense and you know, the ways that, you know, it's very introspective. I mean, it's man is the enemy. The fact that they came, the planet was technically peaceful until man landed on it. I mean, the machine helped, but, you know.
Right. And then apparently at some point they were going to remake the movie, which is always a great idea. But it was J. Michael Straczynski. James Cameron had been involved. That could have been really cool. Joel Silver. And then it just sounds like in the March 2009, it just kind of fell apart.
Nothing. Their wisdom, they're like, you know, let's not and yeah, say we did
again.
Because what would you do? Like, would you literally just do a retelling of the story?
That's what I'm thinking. Like, part of a lot of these older movies, remakes in general are not always a great idea. Sometimes they are. Sometimes the remake ends up being really fantastic and it ends up being even better. But with things like this, where part of the charm is looking at what the effects team was able to pull off in 1956, that to me is the core appeal of Forbidden Planet. Like, you watch it and you're like, oh wow, this is actually really cool. So you take that out of the mix, and what is the movie? Is it just another generic, like,
it would be like, oh wow, look how they created that, I'm sure it was CGI.
And exactly, like, there isn't
there's
much
a spectacle
to...
there.
Yes. So the idea of remaking it is I'm kind of glad that fell through.
Well, like Ocean's 11 is, I think, a good example. Like,
that's exactly that's what I was thinking of too.
Like, the original is so different. I mean, it's like a bank job versus, you know, a casino thing. I mean, really, all that they kept was the core fact of these 11 people get together and do a thing. Like,
yeah,
and it reinvented itself enough to be a remake. And unfortunately, a lot of remakes don't do that at all, and that doesn't work. I mean, I'd have to think long and hard to think of a short list of good remakes. They are out there, but they are definitely the exception, not the rule.
Exactly. Yeah. It's probably for the best. I think the charm of this movie is the era in which it was made, and to really appreciate what it's doing, you have to, it's married to the fact that it was made in the 50s, and you can't just take it out of that. It's also amazing, again, seeing Leslie Nielsen kind of take on the role of, like, the hunky captain is awesome. And I will never stop saying he looks like Daniel Craig, because that was it was just baffling to see him in a serious role. But I think there's so much for film fans, for people who don't know much about it. It's worth a watch, I would say. You know, don't expect to be completely blown away. Don't expect it to be the greatest thing you've ever seen. But go into it with an open mind, and also just, like, marvel at some pretty incredible filmmaking and effects work, and just the advent of that kind of storytelling in science fiction. It's really, really awesome. Is there anything else we want to touch on, or is that pretty much it? Have we wrapped it up?
We talked about the effects, the music, the robot, the id, ego, and
those
super
are the,
ego.
Those are the key things to any movie, because that's a successful recipe
right there.
A great film.
No, I think that's it. I mean, just again, I think you hit it where you said it's the spectacle, the giant set, and where like most of the spacecraft is actually built right there, and you feel like it's there. Even the distance effect where they have Robbie driving up in his car, and it's, you know, it's just smoke blown up through a slot in the ground, but you know they're all like, look, it's a car moving over there really fast.
Like, okay, sure,
like, sure, that's fine. Okay, but I mean, and the fact that it's everything is on a set, everything is in an artificial creation, but I think they really, the selling point for me is how they just info dump the Krell, and because they're showing it so much besides just telling you, and they still let you fill in your head. Like, they don't say, oh, here's a picture of the Krell. They're like, oh no, here's their doorways. Like, that's so clever.
That's something I liked a lot too.
And you feel it's like Fantastic Voyage and, you know, just Journey to the Center of the Earth. And it's like the, you know, the serials, like that's what, you know, is from this time. So I think any person who loves science fiction, you should have it in your collection just to watch every once in a while. And it's also great. I mean, I could see this showing to the kids and getting them into it. I mean, there's really nothing overtly violent about it. I mean, maybe the Krell is a little much at the end if you're a little squeamish about that, but it's, you know, it's just an animation. It's definitely a good film. I feel like I pumped up The Abyss a little much when we last talked, so I tried to be a little more even kill on this one. But I'm glad you enjoyed your trip to the Forbidden Planet.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess final ratings. What should I feel like our ranking system or our rating system, should we do Robbies? How many Robbies?
I was thinking either Robbies or
gauges on the Krell machine.
Let's do that. Let's do that. How many gauges of on the Krell machine would you light up for Forbidden Planet, with one being the lowest and five being the highest?
And five being the highest, because there's more than five on that wall, but I know what you mean. For being, I'd say it's a solid four.
Okay.
It's, you know, and I think part of that just comes from its maybe like rewatchability. Like, not that you can't rewatch it, but I'm going to pop in other stuff that I enjoy more often. So it's going to kind of collect dust a little once in a while. But when I do put it in, I know I'm going to enjoy it, and I know I'm going to have a good time. And Robbie, I mean, you can see why he's the star.
Yeah.
You can see why he's the poster. He's that iconic, you know, even though it doesn't happen in the movie, like carrying the damsel in distress with laser beams, and, you know, that it's so striking.
Yes.
But yeah, I'd give it a four dials on the Krell super machine.
I think I'll give it four as well, because like you said, it's not I don't know that I'd call it a masterpiece, but it does feel like a landmark film, and it's very entertaining. It's a tight story. It's got great effects, and there's so much here that works that it's just good filmmaking. I think at the end of the day, it's good filmmaking, and that's what's really admirable about it, and impressive considering how kind of schlocky the genre would even be after this. Like, it would still be seen kind of as a cheap sort of gimmicky thing.
Right.
So the fact that they put the time and effort and money into making something that felt special and significant is really, really cool, especially this early on in the history of science fiction. So yeah,
well, like you
I
said,
really
it's
enjoyed
the story,
it.
You know, because I could see them saying, oh, well, Forbidden Planet worked, so my science fiction movie is going to work too. And it's like, yeah, but your story wasn't good. And unfortunately,
exactly.
We know a lot of movies that get past that story stage when they really shouldn't.
Yes.
And then people put money on it, and it's like, no, this never should have left the writing room.
Well, but I think, you know, something that should always leave the writing room and should always be shared with the entire world is your podcast, SETI Alpha 3. And also, I mean, you're all over the internet just doing amazing things. So share with the good people at home where they can find you, should they so desire.
Yeah, they can listen to me here on the Nerd Party Network with Philip and Daniel as we talk about Star Trek on SETI Alpha 3 as we're stranded, the three of us on the planet. No Robbies. but they can find me all around the internet under username Dr. Sci-Fi, my website, drsci-fi.com, Instagram, TikTok, Twitch, all have Dr. Sci-Fi. And I just love science fiction in general. I love Star Trek, Star Wars, Battlestar, a lot of stars. It's always fun to talk about, and it's definitely my favorite genre, and it's very captivating. So I'm glad we've gotten to share this science fiction tale.
Yes, and thank you again for giving me the opportunity to see it. And you can find me at Yay Sean Dorman on Twitter, at Sean Dorman on Instagram, and let us know wherever your social media-ing what you think of Forbidden Planet, if you've seen it, if it's underrated, if it's overrated. I want to hear about it. And also, make sure to check out Darren's show, and you can check out all the other great shows on thenerdparty.com, should you so desire, and I think you should. And if you like what you're hearing here, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. If you write a review, I will read your review out loud on a future episode. It'll be wonderful. So why wouldn't you want to do it? So let's see if we can sign off with a word from our good friend Robbie, if he could be so kind.
For your convenience, I am monitored to respond to the name Robbie.